This is number 0071, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0071. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mary Schrock, who grew up Amish, but left that world behind. She is the author of the book, The Greater Inheritance.
There's an aspect of it that the world doesn't know. They have trials, temptations, and problems with the young people, just like anybody else in the outside world does not know that. They think it's just a very peaceful lifestyle, which it is not, because it's very controlled. You're very limited what you can do. You don't have the freedom to choose what you want to believe. You have to abide by their rules, or else you're out.
Nigel Marvin is the newly appointed ambassador to China's famous Chengdu Panda Base. Good news, panda numbers might be on the rise.
We've learned now how to breed them. So in the past, people thought pandas weren't interested in sex at all, but actually the female is only on hot heat for 2 or 3 days a year, and now scientists have cracked that problem.
Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, is back with a year-ender of science news and a look to the future.
Space-wise, it was really pretty busy. Astronomers around the world were making huge headlines with really neat stuff and sort of pushing literally the frontiers of our universe.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, including, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0071, was David Tyler. David does voiceover work for TV, radio, and your YouTube videos. Yes, YouTube videos. At davidtyler.com, he also fills his free time as a small business marketing coach at bigshotsmarketing.ca. You can get a free 30-minute consultation and get tons of useful information from the free small business marketing blog, which is bigshotsmarketing.ca/blog. Thank you very much, David, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a story from Wisconsin. A Wisconsin postal worker says he simply wanted to cheer up a woman on his rounds who seemed stressed out when he decided to deliver mail in the buff. Upon further review, the worker told police that delivering mail while completely naked probably wasn't a good idea. A police report says the 52-year-old man told the woman he would deliver the mail in the nude to her office in Whitefish Bay to make her laugh. The report says that on December 4th, he brought the mail wearing only a smile. The mail carrier was arrested for lewd and lascivious behavior several days later. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says the man admitted delivering the mail naked was a stupid thing to do. Well, speaking as a guy, this postal worker must have great self-esteem, because no guy I know wants to get naked to make a woman laugh. But I digress. Meanwhile, continuing our naked theme, a man caught in the buff in a South Mississippi church cemetery says he was trying to take photographs of spirits. Robert Hurst told the Picayune Item newspaper that he shed his clothes because he believes skin is the best canvas to show spirits' orbs of energy. The 47-year-old said he only intended to remove a shirt, but he took off all of his clothes, a move he now calls stupid. Do you see a theme here? Authorities had set up a motion-activated camera to try to catch vandals. Shane Tucker, the chief deputy in Pearl River County, said Hurst was not accused of vandalism, but the camera caught an unexpected image of Hurst naked. Hurst faces a misdemeanor charge of indecent exposure. Now, wait a minute. Indecent to whom, by the way? He's in a cemetery at night. The only people who would be seeing him are dead or spirits. Can you really be indecent to a spirit? I'm just asking. I'm not familiar with all the laws. Anyway, moving right along, Aline Brown, age 28, and Shmeko Vashon Thomas, age 37, were arrested at a department store in Edmond, Oklahoma, after allegedly shoplifting and concealing the stolen items in the folds of their body fat. Now, you might think, well, it's probably things like jewelry and other small items, but you'd be wrong. Police found a wallet and gloves and a pair of jeans, a pair of boots, and other items worth more than $2,500, which is enough to make the charges felonies. Now, which job would you rather have? The officer who had to search them or the store clerk who had to accept the returns? That's a tough choice. On to Santa Ana, California, a Festivus for the rest of us. A convicted drug dealer in California thinks so. He cited his adherence to the holiday celebrated on a famous episode of Seinfeld to get better meals at the Orange County Jail. Malcolm Alarmo King disliked the salami meals served at the jail, so he used his devotion to Festivus as a reason to get kosher meals reserved for inmates with religious needs. Keeping kosher is not one of the tenets of Festivus, by the way, which was depicted on Seinfeld as celebrated with the airing of grievances and the display of an aluminum pole. Sheriff spokesman Ryan Burris said King got salami-free meals for 2 months before the county got the order thrown out in court.
Many Christmases ago, I went to buy a doll for my son. I reached for the last one they had, but so did another man. As I rained blows upon him, I realized there had to be another way.
What happened to the doll?
It was destroyed. But out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, an Austrian court has recently fined a 63-year-old citizen identified only as Helmut G. for yodeling while mowing his lawn. He was told by the court that his yodeling offended his next-door Muslim neighbors, who accused him of trying to mock and imitate the call of the muezzin. In Muslim tradition, the muezzin is the chosen person at a mosque who leads the call to prayer at Friday services and the five daily times of prayer. Unfortunately for Helmut G., his neighbors were in the middle of prayer when he started to yodel, so he was fined 800 euros after judges ruled that he did indeed try to offend his neighbors and ridicule their beliefs. Helmut G. insisted that, quote, "It was not my intention to imitate or insult them. I simply started to yodel a few tunes because I was in such a good mood," unquote. Well, I guess the judge was a mood buzzkiller. You know, sometimes it's hard to understand people's religions, which actually brings us to our first guest here on the Stuff File program. There's another witty, catchy segue. What's it like to grow up Amish? No refrigerators or washing machines, no music or television, no indoor plumbing. Well, on the line with us right now is someone who lived that experience. Her name is Mary Schrock, who spent the first 26 years of her life in Amish communities in Iowa and Missouri. She has written about those experiences in her memoir entitled The Greater Inheritance. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, explain the title of your book, The Greater Inheritance.
Well, that's just to jump right into that. It's kind of difficult to put it in a few words, I guess. But when we, as you said, we grew up Amish. And when you leave the Amish circles, you leave their religion, you are excommunicated and you're kicked out, which is what happened to us. And you're also cut off from the inheritance. You don't get anything of your father's possessions or, you know, estate or anything. And we knew that when we left, but it was still hard. I mean, it was a very difficult decision. And where that title comes from is when we realized we had to come to grips with the fact that we may not get any of these earthly inheritance, but through the things that we had learned from the Bible and which caused us to see that we do have the liberty to leave in God's eyes, we have the liberty to do that. We realize that we have a much greater inheritance to look forward to in eternity than any of these earthly possessions that we could ever wish for.
Well, we in the mainstream world, we in the mainstream world all hear about what life is like in the Amish community, and I'm sure our understanding of it is somewhat skewed. What's the biggest misconception that we have of the Amish world? And also, I'll ask you, what was the biggest misconception you had when you left that Amish world about the outside world?
About the outside world? That's a good question. A big misconception that a lot of the outside world has about the Amish is that they're a very peaceful, very, you know, good people, which, you know, in a sense they are. They're honest, upright, and I must, you know, preface this conversation with, I did learn a lot of good things growing up Amish, and I'm thankful for that. It wasn't all bad. But there was, there's a aspect of it that the world doesn't know. They have trials, temptations, and problems with the young people, and a lot of things, just like anybody else in the outside world does not know that. They think it's just a very peaceful lifestyle, which it is not, because it's very controlled. You're very limited what you can do, and you don't have the freedom to choose what you want to believe. You have to abide by their rules, or else you're out. And that's what we came to realize when we started studying the Bible, that that's not what matters in God's eyes, is following those rules. What matters is whether or not we trust Him for eternal life and Him only, and they do not agree with that. And so when that was the difference between us, and, of course, when we refused to repent of that and deny it, then they would no longer tolerate us.
So what was the biggest misconception for you entering the outside world?
I guess it was much harder. We did not anticipate the culture shock that we ran into, because it was like landing on a different planet, and we did not anticipate the difficulty, you know, in getting a job and just to get back on your feet. It was basically starting from scratch, because especially my husband and I, we did not have much to bring with us. It was basically our two small children and the clothes on our back, and we started from the bottom. And, you know, it was a hard, long struggle, but God was with us all the way, and He provided abundantly, and we just... You never knew. I mean, we did not know what the next step, or we did not know a day ahead what was going to happen, and you just took one day at a time, believing what we were doing was the right thing to do.
Looking back at that experience, you say you and your husband and your two small children at the time, this is all you had known for 26 years. I'm assuming your husband was in a similar situation. This must have been... and you mentioned the Bible several times. This must have been a huge leap of faith to leave that behind, yes, to venture to the outside world.
It was. It was a tremendous step, you know, just to go against everything we had ever been taught, and to really get that into our head that this is okay. According to the Bible, this is okay. It's not wrong to drive a car. In Jesus' days, He utilized the most modern conveniences that were available at the time, and that's not what matters to God, whether you sit behind a wheel or on the passenger side. Because growing up, we were allowed to sit on a, you know, ride in a vehicle, but we're not allowed to sit behind a wheel. And we came to see, what sense does that make? And we realized it doesn't make sense, and just a lot of inconsistencies like that. And we realized that that's not what matters. I mean, that's not... has nothing to do with eternal life and trusting Christ for eternal life. And that was just a real, real freedom and a liberty that we really, really appreciate.
So you left that world behind. You became a Baptist. You had, if I'm not mistaken, three more children?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. So you've spent now, obviously, many, many years outside of the Amish world. Do you have no connection with anybody there? What about family? What about friends? Or were you totally cut off and that world is completely behind you?
We were at first. At first, they were just very hostile against us. And I write a lot about that in the book, how they would come and flock in, you know, in meetings and try to persuade us. And it was just a very stressful time. But as time went on, after about 20, 25 years into it, after we left, they began to kind of warm up a little more towards us. And I can visit my family now, where at first they told us, don't bring your vehicle on our property. We don't want to see you that way. And basically they disowned us. But now I guess they came to see that we did not go crazy. We did not go out there and just live it up and go off the deep end. They know we still believe what we proclaimed at the time. And they see that our children are living for the Lord. And I think it speaks loudly to them. And now they, even though they don't agree 100% with us, they have come a long ways. And they do let us come visit. Now, that's my side of the family. But my husband's side, they're a little more conservative still. And they maybe visit with you if you run into them, but they will not allow you into their house hardly, or they'd rather not see you. They'd rather you just stay away because you might be a threat to their children and their family, you know.
Mm. Now, isn't there a period in Amish life as a teenager where you do get to, for a period of time, experience the outside world?
That is very rare. There might be a few places out in the east, like Ohio or Pennsylvania, where that might be tolerated, but as a general rule, no. If they do not want their boys and girls to get a taste of the world at all, they try very hard to protect them and keep them within their circles because they believe they're a failure if even one of them leaves, and they work very, very hard to protect them, try to keep them within their family, within their circles.
What is the terminology? There is a terminology for that, though, when the kids go off for a while.
A lot of them call it rumspringa.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it is very rare most states that's not a common thing, but I have heard of it, and I guess it does happen somewhat in Ohio and places like that, like I said.
Well, I guess a lot of this has to do, this whole situation has to do with, in a nutshell, tolerance. So let me ask you this question. If for any reason, especially your two older children who grew up in an Amish community or were started off in an Amish community, if any of your children wanted to go back to that, how would you feel about it?
I would be very, very troubled. It would break our hearts because, excuse me, because we know they would be committing themselves to a very controlled society, and they'd be misled into believing that they can earn eternal life, they can earn their salvation by being good, by dressing the way they do, by not mixing in with the world, by keeping distance from the world, and just a lot of things like that that they would be taught wrong, and they would be depending on that, and they would be very, very disappointed. And yeah, it would grieve us.
Are Amish marriages arranged, and by virtue of that, was your marriage arranged?
No, it wasn't. They do allow them the boys to choose who they want to marry, and as long as it's within the same range of rules that they have, because there are so many different levels of rules and regulations. The system they go by, they all have the basic system, but their rules vary from one community to the other, and some of them are very liberal, and others are very ultra-conservative. So we grew up in the more like ultra-conservative. We would not have been allowed to, my family would not have allowed us to go marry somebody from one of these liberal ones where they were what they esteemed to be fancy dresses, you know, things like that. They would have not approved of that. But other than that, they were not arranged.
It's a very interesting, eye-opening look at what happens in an Amish community. The book is called The Greater Inheritance, and it's written by Mary Schrock. And Mary, I thank you very, very much for being on the program.
Thank you so much. And I might just mention, it's available on my website at thegreaterinheritance.com. And also on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble.
Thank you, Mary. Mary Schrock, author of The Greater Inheritance. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0071, and you can find links to Mary's site and to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to animal expert Nigel Marvin. Plus, we'll also check in with Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day, plus lots more stuff right here, right now. Brian Hopper, age 54, of Encino, California, was on a raft trip down the Sacramento River when his raft sprang a leak, stranding him on a deserted island. He fashioned a crude SOS sign and waited for someone to find him. After 5 days of eating native plants, he called his cousin. The cousin, Sean Reeves, contacted the Coast Guard, who staged a rescue. Yes, Hopper had his cell phone with him, but never called 911. This is a quote. I was embarrassed to be stranded on an island. I didn't want to spend the taxpayers' money to have the Coast Guard come rescue some stupid guy. Gee, now he tells us. You know, Brian came very close to being this week's idiot of the day. Very close. But he's not. We'll get to that later. Okay, the Stuff File gets its share of sick stories, but I think this one is just about as sick as it gets. In Oklahoma, police have arrested 21-year-old Mark Anthony Richardson Jr., who allegedly had a bad habit of fooling babysitters into thinking he was severely autistic and getting them to change his diapers. He later told police he did it for a sexual purpose. Now, the babysitters told police he would get sexually aroused when they cleaned him while changing his diapers. I did say babysitters plural, which means he's done this more than once. Yes. Richardson also allegedly grabbed the breast of one babysitter's 18-year-old daughter during an overnight stay in September. Her mother told her to go back to sleep because he did not know what he was doing. Well, now he faces a felony count of sexual battery and 7 misdemeanor counts of outraging public decency. Richardson, who stands all of 4 feet 9 inches tall, is being held in the Oklahoma County Jail, where I'm sure he'll make a whole bunch of new friends. Prosecutors allege Richardson found his victims from babysitting ads placed online at Craigslist by David, and I'm doing air quotes here, the autistic boy's dad. He would show up at the doorstep of a babysitter with $40 and a note from David, a typed note, that said he needed to be fed. He would be wearing a soiled diaper and very old clothes. He also had a backpack with diapers, ointment, a bottle, and a pacifier. Now, what frightens me here about this story is not the fact that he executed this plan, because, let's face it, that is sick and twisted enough on its own right. I would just like to go through the thought process he went through in hatching this scheme. That is a different kind of mind, to say the least. Wow. Okay, moving right along. First rule of getting caught: no matter how obvious it looks, deny everything. In Bradenton, Florida, Jesse Lynn Clark actually pulled out oxycodone and Xanax pills from her crotch during a police traffic stop and immediately told officers they weren't hers. The pills were wrapped in a paper towel, and Ms. Clark told officers that the driver of the vehicle had told her to put the drugs down her pants. Well, the driver denied that, so Clark was charged with 2 counts of possession of a controlled substance and got to spend the night in jail. Ladies, if you will put stuff down your pants because someone asked you to, that is true love. Okay, hey mom and dad, might want to check those kids' backpacks before sending them back to school after the winter break. In Oklahoma City, a 13-year-old 7th grader was arrested in school and accused of violating a little-known ordinance that prohibits possession of a permanent marker in some circumstances. Now, the teen was caught using a permanent marker at Roosevelt Middle School by a teacher. Teacher DeLynn Woodside noted the marker had bled through a piece of paper onto the desk and reported to a police officer that she had also seen the teen writing on the desk with the marker. So, she made a citizen's arrest, and a police officer transferred the student to the community intervention center that houses juveniles who have been arrested. Under City Ordinance 35-202, it is illegal for any person to possess spray paint or a permanent marker on private property without the permission of the property owner. The school says they'll look into the incident after winter break. Pinheads. The school is run by pinheads. Okay, and finally, in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, Taiwan is using an interesting method to make sure their medical students appreciate the value of life. Teenagers at Rende Medical School are being buried alive in coffins. No, I'm not making this up. This is actually happening. The students have to write a will, dress in a funeral shroud, and then climb into a coffin while they are buried under floorboards before they are released. Professor Ki Danning explains, although it's just 10 minutes, the effect is equal to real death. Student Chow Lin said, I felt like I was reborn when I came out, and now I know that every second counts in life. So, you didn't think every second counted before? And you're a medical student, right? Wow. You know, sometimes the animals seem brighter, don't they? Which is my segue to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. Where do I come up with these segues? One after another. Wow. Nigel Marvin is the newly appointed ambassador to China's famous Chengdu Panda Base. He's also British TV's foremost and wackiest animal expert. He's currently traveling in the United States, and he joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Nigel.
Hi, how are you doing? Hello.
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, talk about the new role you have as the ambassador to China's Chengdu Panda Base.
Yeah, well, it's a great honor. We were doing a series there, and I think the Chinese realized how much I adored pandas and also how much I loved working there in Chengdu. It's the capital of Sichuan province. And they asked me to get across to the rest of the world, as well as the television series, by interviews like this and by talking to people about the great work that's being done at the Chengdu Panda Base. This year they had 19 baby pandas born, which is a world record, 19 cubs.
Wow. Now, we've heard a lot over the years about the pandas and how rare they are. With so much care and interest taken in the pandas, why does it seem to be so difficult to bump up their numbers, as it were?
Well, that's the good news, really. Actually, we've learned now how to breed them. So in the past, people thought pandas weren't interested in sex at all, but actually the female is only on hot heat for 2 or 3 days a year, and now scientists have cracked that problem, and they do hormonal tests in Chengdu and other breeding establishments around the world. They know precisely when the female's ready to mate, so they're getting a lot of cubs. And the other thing is, it's a sort of evolutionary throwback. Pandas often have twins. In the wild, one of those babies always dies because a mother doesn't have enough milk. They may have had twins when they didn't specialize in feeding on bamboo and had a more nutritious diet, but now, because bamboo has such little goodness, they cannot produce enough milk for two babies. But in captivity, they've worked out a neat and elegant solution of where they take one of the babies away and bottle feed it, then they swap them, so each baby has quality time with mother and gets extra food from the milk given by the human carers. So both of the twins now survives in captivity, which is really boosting the numbers. There's about 2,200 giant pandas in the world, around 200 or so in captivity. And they're breeding them so well now, they're getting to the point that they can release some of them back into the wild.
Now, why is it, first of all, how well do they do in the wild? That's the other question, because, again, their numbers haven't increased over the years. They seem to be increasing, as you say, with human help. Are we saying that on their own, pandas would not survive?
No, we're saying that we mucked around with the environment so much, with the great rate of development in China, the bamboo forests were cut down, there were roads going through the bamboo forest, but now, you know, the Chinese government has realized giant pandas are such an icon of China that they have to be protected. So there's at least 50 panda reserves, and they're working at the moment to do these panda motorways, if you like, these corridors of habitat between the different areas of bamboo. So if the bamboo dies off after flowering, which happens, you know, every decade or so, then the pandas have got somewhere to move, somewhere else to go to find food. So, you know, things are looking great. Now, George Schaller, I mean, I'm not a complete panda expert like George Schaller, who was an American biologist who was studying them, you know, 20 years ago. And he said at that point he thought, you know, pandas had no chance. But recently he's come out and said things are looking pretty optimistic for the giant panda now, with this network of reserves and the fact that they can be bred easily, not easily, but they can be bred readily now in captivity, means that the future for the giant panda is, in fact, pretty good.
When we think of pandas, we naturally think of China. Is there any place that pandas naturally or could possibly exist?
No, China is really the only place where they've ever, as far as I know, ever been found, even back in geological history. They need this bamboo. I mean, why I love them so much is not because they're cute and cuddly. In fact, they're not cute and cuddly. They've got quite a powerful bite on them, and the fur is fibrous and coarse. It's not soft as you imagine it to be. But I like them because, you know, they're a bear that feeds on bamboo. They've got as much right to be called a bear as a grizzly or a polar, but they specialize in feeding on bamboo. So that is an extraordinary adaptation to me. 99% of their diet is bamboo shoots and leaves. If they find a bee's nest, they like honey like all other bears. If there's a dead animal around, they will eat a bit of meat, but they mainly feed on bamboo. Would seem an idyllic lifestyle. They have to feed for up to 14 hours a day, but in fact it's not, because they get such little nutrition from the bamboo. That's why they have to feed for such long periods of time. So it's difficult getting enough energy to survive on bamboo. If there's a choice between going up a hill or down a hill, they'll go down because they don't want to waste energy climbing up hills. So they're always on a knife edge of not having enough energy because of this low nutrition bamboo diet. So they need big areas of land with bamboo to survive.
I mentioned in the introduction that you're from Britain and you are currently in the United States as an ambassador to China's Panda base. What do you hope to accomplish traveling through the United States?
Well, it's just talking to people, you know, and for once it's a sort of good news story, really. You know, pandas are doing well in captivity. These reserves, it's not just good for the pandas. It means there's a whole suite of other species that are saved as well that rely on the bamboo forest. Wonderful golden monkeys, tarkin, which is a type of goat antelope that lives in the high mountains where the pandas live. Golden pheasants, it's a beautiful bird. It was once considered to be a candidate to be the national bird of China. They haven't got one yet, but it's a beautiful red and gold pheasant. So all of these animals and plants rely on these high mountain habitats. It's one of the most beautiful habitats on earth in Sichuan and Shanxi, where the pandas are found. And, you know, seeing them, you know, up close and personal in the Chengdu Panda Base, you know, that's great fun too. And whenever I go, there's a lot of, met some tourists from Canada there actually last time I was there. Everyone loves seeing pandas close up, and obviously zoos in the West only have one or two or a few of them, but in China there's nearly 90 at the Panda Base, which is incredible, seeing that number of pandas. So it's really getting the message across that it is not all doom and gloom for giant pandas now.
You mentioned they only eat bamboo, so obviously they're not predators. Is there something out there that they are prey to?
Yes, in the habitat that they live in, there are wild dogs and leopards. And some scientists think that black and white color is in fact a warning coloration that, you know, I may be slow, but in fact I've got quite a powerful bite on me. And, you know, they are the ultimate bamboo crunching machines. Their molars are seven times bigger than my molar teeth, and they have got a very powerful bite, short jaws with a lot of musculature attached, so they're very, very powerful. And in fact, in the past, when you know, zookeepers believed the panda publicity, they'd go in with adults, and you know, some have been badly injured, even having an arm amputated because of being bitten by a giant panda. So they can defend themselves. They're not cute and cuddly and as slow as we think they are.
As you say, since their diet subsides mostly of bamboo, do you think there's ever a time in the future where they can possibly succeed in the wild more than they are now?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, they're trying to put aside more habitat for them, and you know, the reserves really are sacrosanct. There's nobody going in there illegally logging the trees, or you know, cause they need big hollow trees to actually have their babies, or caves. So if they lose these hollow trees, that's a problem for them as well, because they haven't got a nursery to have their babies. So, you know, I think it's looking pretty good for them. And in the past, some may have died because of bamboo die-off, because they didn't have anywhere to go when the bamboo died. But now there's some spare habitat left, and the Chengdu Panda Base are doing experiments at the end of the year where they're putting some of their captive pandas in a huge enclosure and watching how they can survive and how they can find their own bamboo. And that's the first steps of boosting the wild population by releasing some of the captive animals, which must, of course, be the purpose of any captive breeding program, eventually to release some of those animals back into the wild if there is the right habitat.
Here in Canada, there is some excitement because we are about to receive some pandas at our zoos from China, and that's always big news when that happens, no matter where the zoos are that accept pandas from China. What do you think it is? You mentioned your excitement and like for the animals. What do you think it is about the general population that is so enamored with the pandas? Is it just the rarity of it?
I think the rarity definitely plays a part. I think that black and white coloration plays a part. I think the big eyes, they're not really that big, the eyes, but they've got those black eye patches, which makes them look, you know, very sweet. The fact that it's a peculiar kind of bear, you know, they're so mysterious and enigmatic, difficult to see in the wild. And, you know, they are, I suppose, the ultimate Chinese icon. Not a lot of people know that, obviously, the Canadian zoos won't be given the pandas. It's not like in the past where there was panda diplomacy going on and the Chinese government would give a panda like they gave Chi Chi to Britain, and that panda then belonged to the UK. Now zoos pay the Chinese government to virtually hire the pandas from them, and any babies that are born in Canada or the States or anywhere else in the world eventually have to be returned back to China, and the money that they receive goes back into these conservation programs. So you know, they really are exclusively Chinese pandas, and no one can own one outside of that country.
Fascinating stuff indeed. People can find more information by going to your website, which is nigelmarvin.com. Nigel, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, it was great speaking to you. Thank you so much.
British wildlife presenter, television producer, and author Nigel Marvin. You can check out his website at www.nigelmarvin.com, and Marvin is spelled M-A-R-V-E-N. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0071, and you'll find links to Nigel's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones. Many people thought the day would never come, but after years of debate and speculation, it couldn't be avoided any longer. I'm talking about a major U.S. city imposing an actual lawsuit tax on its citizens. Last week, I talked about a hidden lawsuit tax that all Americans pay. We don't see it on our receipts, but we pay for it through higher prices on products and services. For years, though, this tax has been hidden. But now, residents of Detroit, Michigan are actually seeing a charge on their property tax bills for a special lawsuit tax. School officials there say that they've had to pay for so many lawsuits, they just can't afford to pay for them out of the general fund anymore. But this isn't just a Detroit problem. Cities across the country are reporting record payouts for lawsuits. Experts believe lawsuit taxes may spread if we don't address the problem of lawsuit abuse in America. Has your city ever made you pay a special lawsuit tax? I'd like to hear from you. Go to my website at bobdirigojones.com. That's Bob, D-O-R-I-G-O, Jones.com.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we have Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, and of course an idiot of the day. But first, a couple of Stuff File stories before we get to our next guest. 19 Pakistani girls set a new record when they stuffed themselves into a smart car with all the doors and windows closed for 10 seconds. The previous record was held by a group of 18 Australian girls. Now, this would be the worst time, by the way, to get car sick. Also, flatulence is not a good idea at this point either. Of course, there's a video. There's always video footage of things like this, which you can find on YouTube if you want to take a look. And I'll even make it easy for you. I've taken the liberty of putting the link up on the Stuff File page at thestufffile.com, so you can go there and take a look. And elsewhere, it's just sickening to think of a 25-year-old man trying to rape a 71-year-old woman. But that's what happened in Hutchinson, Kansas. Now, I do have sensibilities, which is why I don't usually share such stories of sexual assault on the show. But in this case, don't worry, Grandma won, and the would-be rapist spent several days in the hospital after his intended victim and her frying pan got through with him. The accused is 25-year-old Kevin Scott Funderburk, who was jailed on suspicion of attempted rape, aggravated battery, criminal restraint, and criminal damage to property. He allegedly talked his way into the residence of the victim, a 71-year-old female, under the guise he was homeless and had nowhere to go. But once in the home, he reportedly attacked the woman, held her down, and attempted to rape her. During the struggle, she managed to grab hold of a frying pan and give him the beatdown of the century. Hit him again. Again. When police arrived, they found Funderburk unconscious and lying in his own vomit in the back of the house. Police took him to the hospital, where he had to have his scalp stapled. I just love this woman. You go, girl. Anyway, we have an idiot of the day coming up in just a matter of moments, but let's get to our last guest first. Joining us on the program once again is Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, and he's here on the Stuff File with a bit of a year-ender and a look ahead at space science. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
So here we are at the end of 2010. What can you say about the year that was?
Well, you know, space-wise, it was really pretty busy. I mean, there was astronomers around the world were making huge headlines with really neat stuff and sort of pushing literally the frontiers of our universe.
What was that? I know there was one story I heard just recently that had something to do with arsenic.
That's right.
Which has everyone in a tizzy. What's that all about?
NASA basically had this teaser press release put out at the beginning of December saying that they were going to have a press conference announcing that they made a special discovery that will have implications on astrobiology, our search for extraterrestrial life. And that sent the blogosphere ablaze with all kinds of speculations. And then the second week in December, they held their press conference announcing that they've discovered microbes in a lake, in a very poisonous lake in out in California that munches on arsenic. And not only just eats arsenic, but also has incorporated it into its DNA. So it was very interesting and never been seen before. And it does indeed have implications for our search for life everywhere. But of course, a lot of people, I think, were disappointed not to see the scientists pull out a little ET and have him dancing on the table in front of everybody.
I guess the implication here is the fact that up until now, we've always looked at a life existing as we exist on oxygen, water, and the like. And here is something that exists in a different way. So it might have scientists look at other planets to look at things that might exist differently from the way we do.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, if you look at what they announced, really, it does have a profound impact on our search for life, because we've had a very narrow field of view of what life is about and what are the ingredients that make up life. And here what we found is a building block of life that we never expected to be part of life. So now this opens the door a little bit wider in terms of what we need to look for when we're searching for life on other moons, for instance, or planets within our solar system, even. Places like the moons of Jupiter, Europa, Callisto are going to be looked at again. The moon of Saturn called Titan is another great example of places we're going to go and do another look, a second look at these places of maybe they are hosting life, even now, currently.
Speaking of opening a door, it seems to be that the door is quickly closing on the shuttle program, but it's opening up a door to private companies?
That's right. There's basically a small handful group of corporations that are vying to basically get a large contract from NASA to be the next ferry service to this International Space Station, ferrying all kinds of things, everything from food and supplies to astronauts themselves up back and forth from the space station. Just this month in December, we saw the company SpaceX, run by Elon Musk, formerly the fellow that had invented PayPal, became a billionaire on it. He has this startup space company, and they've already launched their first private rocket, demonstrating even the crew capability of being able to bring up astronauts up there. And their first test flight was fantastic. So it bodes very well for the private industry to take over some of NASA's, you know, basically chores of being the trucking service to the space station.
As someone who works in science, as you do, for you, what was the gee whiz factor of 2010?
Well, you know, some very interesting stuff happened in terms of looking for exoplanets. This is really the year of I think the first year of our search for worlds beyond our solar system that maybe not just finding a planet, but finding something that it resembles Earth to some extent. And late this fall, in October, there was an announcement that actually it proved controversial later on, but made waves in the astronomical community that they had found a planet outside our solar system that had an atmosphere, had temperate regions, and had things like, most important for life, it would be liquid water. And this was amazing. This was a planet that was three times bigger than the Earth that has been discovered. And it's amazing. I mean, there's possibilities that aliens could exist on a planet like this. This was the first time we found something like this. And I think it bodes for really great things in 2011. A lot of people are saying that this may be just the beginning of us being able to find that sister Earth out there beyond our solar system.
And speaking of looking ahead, we have just a few more moments. What are you looking forward to the most in the next year?
I think there's a few things. The last space shuttle launch that is now scheduled for April. It's going to be an amazing early morning launch in the pre-dawn hours on April 1st right now. It's Space Shuttle Endeavour going up to visit the space station for one last time. And after that, all the space shuttles will be mothballed. So that's in April. Looking forward to the launch of the next Mars rover in August of 2011. It's a Volkswagen Beetle-sized rover that's going to be launched in August, and it'll be going on Mars, probably spending many years looking around, this one specifically, for signs of life on Mars. So that'll be very interesting. And there's a really cool meteor shower that's being forecast on October 8th, 2011. It's called the Draconids. It's usually a real humdrum shower, not much to talk about, but it might become a storm, and it might actually pose a risk to spacecrafts and the space station, and we're talking about literally hundreds up to maybe thousands of meteors per hour peaking in the overnight hours of in early October.
And speaking of peaking in the overnight hours, anything you want to discuss in the last moments we have, talking about what backyard astronomers can look forward to in the next couple of months?
Well, definitely, I think one of the big things right now is planet Jupiter. I recommend everyone do take a look. It's in the southwestern skies, dominating the entire evenings. And what's cool about Jupiter is that it's been missing one of its cloud belts, dark brown cloud belts. Usually has two. It's had one this past year. It's disappeared for some mysterious reason, and in just the last few weeks, it's been returning. There's signs of its return, and astronomers are urging backyard sky watchers to keep an eye on this. It's going to be quite a dramatic return for this cloud formation on Jupiter.
Something to look forward to, definitely. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the program, Andrew, to talk about what's going on in science and also in the heavens. How can people find you, as usual?
Well, people can find me on my website, thenightskyguy.com. Also, they can watch me on the Weather Channel in Canada every Friday night on my night sky spot. And people can visit me on my YouTube channel and invite people to ask questions on my Facebook as well. All these links are available on my website, thenightskyguy.com.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And, of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Here's a free tip. It's best not to carjack the taxi you just called to pick you up at your house. In St. Petersburg, Florida, 22-year-old LaSharon Nicole Butler was arrested on charges she attacked a cab driver with a sharp instrument, then carjacked his cab. She had called the Blue Star cab to pick her up at her home and take her to another residence, but asked the cab driver to wait for her. When Butler emerged from the house, she was allegedly smoking a marijuana joint and got back into the cab. That's when she reached around from the back seat and grabbed the driver around the head and neck, cutting him in the face and throat. The cab driver broke free and ran from the cab while Butler hopped into the front seat and drove off. The cab was later abandoned. But of course, she was easy to find because she called the cab from her own house. Why would someone call a cab from their own house, have them take them someplace, and then carjack the cab? One reason, and one reason only, she's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0071. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0071. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you could also find me at facebook.com/PAHolder and at twitter.com/PAHolder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air at World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.